So welcome to Postcarbon Radio, where we examine converging systemic failures in economy, ecology, and human coexistence on Earth. Rather than despair of these crises, we see them as related symptoms of a larger system that doesn't work, in which we can choose to replace. In that spirit, we search for concrete solutions, transformative visions, and ways to get there together. We look at hard realities with you on the show, remembering that big crises are also big opportunities we can act on together, building community resilience as we go. We believe that facing the facts and our deepest fears can paradoxically unearth our fondest wishes and best collaborative, creative nature. Won't you become a paradigm warrior? Join us in envisioning and building a radically better future on today's edition of Postcarbon Radio. And our show today are some audio files that I took at the Earth at Risk conference that occurred in San Francisco on November 22nd and 23rd. Which featured keynote speakers as Vandana Shiva, Alice Walker, Chris Hedges, Derek Jensen, Thomas Lindsay, and many more. Here, I'll just read from the brochure. Here are some of the world's preeminent strategists in environmental defense, social justice, and grassroots activism came together to share their insights and speak toward one goal, crafting game-changing responses to address the converging crisis we face: species extinction, racism, sexual warfare, deforestation, global warming, corruption, all stem from the same root. For too long, environmentalism has hinged on conformity to capitalism and the status quo. For too long, social justice work has capitulated to this profoundly abusive culture. We may live on Earth at risk, but with this great challenge comes a great opportunity. This is your struggle, whether you acknowledge it or not. Will you sit on the sidelines as the world burns? So today, our program, I'm featuring Indigenous voices, because I feel we need to listen to their knowledge. They've lived sustainably for many generations on Earth, and we can learn so much from them. They, from their traditional ecological knowledge, cultural landscape protection and policies, their worldviews, lifeways, and spiritual values connected to place. And this program features two panels. Jeanette Armstrong, an Okanagan First Nation person from British Columbia, will be speaking, and she was on a panel called Colonization and Indigenous Life. So we'll play the excerpt from Jeanette Armstrong first, and then there'll be another panel called Building Resistance Communities. So here is Jeanette Armstrong.
I just said greetings to everyone from my people, my community. I'm from two sides of occupied Okanagan territory, British Columbia and Washington State. I'm Siouxsie Okanagan. That's my growing up and my understanding that as an Indigenous person, as a Siouxsie person, that the way that we live, the way that we grew up, the way that I grew up in my community was a healthy way to be. Not just the body of health, but the mind and the spirit of health that we as human beings have given to us through our mind intelligence, so that we could achieve a level that we were meant to achieve. And so what I want to talk about today is about that, the idea of shifting from knowing that we're doing something really wrong, that all of us are part of this, from knowing about it to doing something about it. And I think that I really want to thank the sponsors and really want to give great respect to the work that Derek does and others of you that are out there. Obviously, you're here because you care and because you're doing that work, and you're so needed, and every one of you needs to make sure that, you know, 100 people or 1,000 people are listening to you, because they need to hear these things and they need to do these things that you're doing. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the main point of my experience of being Indigenous, and then I want to talk about how that is really foundational, I think, to the idea that we need to shift ourselves. It's not just a matter of, in my mind, lack of chains that we somehow can't understand in our lives, but it's in looking at what it is that makes us human, what it is that makes us what we're doing right now. And so I think that question has to be confronted in a really truthful and a really serious way. Some of the things that Chief here, Ilmihum, in our language here, has brought forward, I think is really way more incredibly important than we put thought to. We think about Indigenous people and we think about, oh, yeah, I support their right to be Indigenous, their right to do their culture, their right to do their things, and I'll stand with them to help do that. But I'm going to turn around and go back and live the way I live and the way I think and the way I am. I think there's something really wrong with that. Because Indigenousness isn't just about culture. I don't even think it's about race. I don't think it's about ethnicity. I think it is about how you respond to the living things in the place that you live. It is a set of values. And you cannot live those values unless you have knowledge about that place. Knowledge about what lives there and why you need to be in tune with that. And why you need to protect that with your life, like some of our people are doing, and protect that against all odds. We don't have things to gain in the material world when we stand in front of those trucks at those roadblocks and we have those guns pointed to us, which we have done up there and every other place in the world. You need to be standing there with us. And you need not only to stand there with us and then go back home, you need to think about what it is to live that way. And so I know that most of you agree with this, so I'm talking to the converted. And so what I want to say about that is that there is a depth of experience from being Indigenous. I'm a fluent speaker. My grandfather, my great-grandfather, was Chief Kankanahua. He was the manager of the whole Upper Columbia River salmon system. There is not one salmon that reaches that community now because of the Grand Coulee Dam. And my grandparents' home is under Lake Roosevelt. That's where I come from, and that's where my emotions come from. But I go every year to all the ceremonies there. In my community at Inchlim, with my brother, with my uncle, with my cousins, and we make those prayers every year to those salmon to return to that place. That's the place we need to get to as all of people, in every place that we're at. We need to understand what drives us to feel that, to experience that, and to know that is how we are supposed to be as human beings. Those are the things that I want to talk about. Those are the things that I want to invite you to be. We invite, as Okanagan people, everybody to come to those ceremonies. We don't close them. We say, you need to feel that. You need to understand that you can be at home here. that you don't have to be the alien here, the colonizer here. You don't have to long to be home. You can belong, but there is a way to do that. And it has to be about the life of the land in the places that you occupy, the living things. They're indigenous because they learned how to be there over millions of years and thousands of years. And we as indigenous peoples learned that road, learned that path with them. That spirit has to be there planet-wide. One of my mentors, John Mohawk, said, it's not about indigenous peoples as ethnicity or race. It's about re-indigenizing the planet. We have to accept that and learn how to do that. And I know that most of you have that in your hearts. I know that most of you feel that. Feel that when things are going so bad, when you go and see the things like the tar sands. If you haven't seen it, go and see it. Look at, if you can't go there, look at Christopher McLeod, Toby McLeod's film, Standing Ground, and you can see what is going on. And feel that. Feel what is happening with the living things, the living water, the living beings that we're displacing and making extinct. In my community, many of the life forms are, we are called a hotspot in Canada of extinct animals and insects and birds. And part of my work every day is to try to move my community, all people, whether you're from the city or whether you're from the reservation, toward replacing those things, toward restoring those things, toward protecting those things, and toward feeling like this is my home and this is why I have to do this. This is why I have to be responsible. So I just wanted to leave that message with you. I know that I'm really emotional, but you need to be this emotional. You need to feel this.
You've just been listening to Jeanette Armstrong from the Okanagan Nation, First Nation in British Columbia. And now I'd like to air a panel, an Indigenous panel, on building resistance communities. They're on the front lines fighting pipelines, extraction, and fracking that are coming across their lands.
What does it take to build oppositional communities capable of achieving their goals? What are the role and structure of leadership in this process? So I will start with doing a brief introduction of each panelist, and then everyone will be given about 10 minutes uninterrupted to share, and then we'll follow that with a discussion. I will start going in order of how folks have seated themselves. Sabah Malik is a political activist who has organized on issues of racism, peak oil, and anti-civilization resistance for many years. The course of her life changed during the 1990s when she visited the remote communities of the Hunza Valley in Pakistan and lived with land-based peoples engaged in sustainable living practices. She is a board member of the Fertile Ground Environmental Institute and is passionately committed to organized political resistance. Next, sitting beside her is Togustai. Togustai received much of his cultural training from his late grandparents. Their teachings brought him through much of the ancient and unceded landscapes. Togustai takes the responsibilities of being a hereditary chief very seriously. His philosophy is based on the ancient Wet'suwet'en philosophy called Wigus, which requires the highest level of understanding, respect, and humility for absolutely everything. There is no price that will ever compromise his responsibility of ensuring that there is always something for his for the unborn generations. Next is Sakej Ward, who belongs to the Wolf Clan. Sakaj is a veteran of both the Canadian and American militaries. He graduated from the University of New Brunswick from the Honors Program with a bachelor's in political science with a specialization in international relations. He also attended the University of Victoria, where he successfully completed the Master's of Arts in Indigenous Governance. He has a long history of advocating and protecting First Nations' inherent responsibilities and freedoms, having spent the last 21 years fighting the government and industry. For his efforts in protecting Indigenous people, freedoms, and territory, he has received the National Aboriginal Achievement Award. Having taught, organized, advised, and led various warrior societies from all over Turtle Island, Sakesh has made warriorhood his way of life. He has been on over a dozen warrior operations and countless protest actions. He dedicates all his time to developing warrior teachings and instructing warrior societies from all over. Lastly, Frida Houston was chosen to be spokesperson for the Oostatin clan in 2008. Her responsibilities as a spokesperson include holding meetings between her hereditary clan chiefs, performing liaison duties with industry and government, coordinate message for media, and research all aspects of which are brought up for discussion regarding clan business. Much of her grounding comes from being raised following the seasonal hunting and fishing on her people's lands and waterways. Both she and Togastai are representatives of the Unistatin Camp, a resistance community whose purpose is to protect sovereign Wet'suwet'en territory from several proposed pipelines from the Tar Sands Giga Project and shale gas from hydraulic fracturing projects in the Peace River region. And we will start with hearing from Sabah.
Thank you. Thank you, first of all, everybody who's here, everybody who came. As an organizer, I want to particularly thank the Wallace Action Fund, without whose generous grant this event would not be possible. And I'm hoping one of our visions for this event was that it wouldn't just be another conference where people came, were inspired for a couple of days, bought a t-shirt and went home. We are hoping that this event just starts something, starts a conversation and translates into some real action. And for that reason, we're encouraging people to take the conversation further. We have an action hub in the lobby where if people are inspired to start new coalitions, new projects, that they can leave their information or their ideas and they can collaborate with some of the amazing grassroots activists who are here, because I know a lot of people have traveled quite far distances to come here and listen to some of these conversations. So thank you for that. I want to start with talking about what resistance means, because it can mean many things. And on one level, I think we often hear about decolonizing ourselves first. The most important work is first to decolonize ourselves from the toxicity of the present culture. And that is the ability to not be adversely affected by something that's toxic. That's one definition of resistance. And in another definition of resistance, it's a refusal. It's a refusal to accept or comply with something. And it doesn't just stop at refusal to accept or comply, but it's an attempt to prevent that something by action or argument. And in another sense, another definition of resistance could be it's the inherent ability of every living organism to resist harmful influences. And so one of the things I think we need to do today is there have been some talk of what it means to be a warrior. I think we just heard from a warrior when she was on the stage telling us her words. That was amazing. And Sakaj turned to me and said, how do we follow that? Well, we're here. We're trying to follow it. We're trying to follow you, Dominique. And I think one of the things that stays with me is a quote from Mel Basil, who says, the way of the warrior is to explore all peaceful methods, and when these fail, to recognize that it's time to do battle. I think that we've reached that point. I think that, we were there, so we've been there for a while. And I say this because we've had what passes for an environmental movement for around 50 years, if we chart the beginning from the publication of Silent Spring by Rachel Carson, that's almost 50 years ago. 50 years of environmentalism in this country, and yet every single living system is in decline. In decline. It's not even stable. It's in decline. And there's not a single peer-reviewed article in the last 30 years that contradicts that statement. So I want to talk a little bit about building communities and what it means to build a community, to build a resistance community. And I'm talking from my own experience of being involved with a couple of groups. One is DGR, which I helped to build. And some of the things that we have learned along the way. And I think that what's really important is that we need hundreds and hundreds of groups working in coalition to face down power. That's what it's going to take if we're going to win. And one of the things I'd say is you have to find a central focus, because there's so much wrong. What's your passion? Is it the oceans? Is it the rivers? Is it the old growth forest? Is it social injustices? I mean, the only good thing, Derek often says this, Derek Jensen, that is, that the only good thing about everything being so screwed up is that there's plenty of work to do. Yeah. And I think we can't, you know, no one group can address everything. So pick your issue. And then don't be one person. Kathleen Dean Moore said, that was her reply in a recent interview she gave, and she was asked, what can one person do? And her answer was, don't be one person. Exactly. Find others who feel passionately about what you feel passionately about. And then create a community around it. And how is that community created? What we've learned in DGR, that it was extremely important to have structure, to have leadership roles, to have norms and rules. And I know that on the left side of politics, those kinds of words, rules and norms are a dirty word almost. And even structure is a dirty word. And I want to say that I really disagree with that. One, because I think Stanley Diamond said something that is very true. And he said there is a difference between the rule of law as opposed to the order of custom. And one of the things I learned when I was in Hunza, which was alluded to in my... I spent some time in Hunza in the 1990s. And at that time, I didn't have the words for it, but what I was experiencing was a land-based sustainable culture. Now, they had no police. They had no written laws. But they had plenty of rules and customs, which they stuck to. And they had structure, and they had leadership, and it was all community-based. And they had strict rules about how you built dwellings, when you cut trees. All of their norms were really based around the health of the land base, because they recognized that nothing is possible unless the land base is healthy. Everything else is irrelevant. You know, everything else becomes irrelevant. And so from there, I want to go on to one of the things that I think has destroyed our ability to collectively organize is horizontal hostility. Now, horizontal hostility was a term that was coined by feminists in the 1970s, which described the infighting or the factionalism in the women's movement. But I think that, you know, we're experiencing that on the left side of politics. Just, it's rampant. And it's destroying our ability to organize collectively and build coalitions. And I want to say, we don't have to agree on everything. We don't have to have exactly the same ideologies. And I was talking about this with my friend Gabe, who's sitting right here, about a month ago, tip of the hat, thank you. And saying that, you know, life on Earth is being systematically killed by the powerful for profit. And if it doesn't matter to me, if somebody understands that, I'm willing to work with them. They don't have to agree with me about everything. And I don't have to agree with them. I'm a mature enough adult to be able to do that. And I think that it's time that we put our differences aside and find the things that we agree on and work towards creating powerful allyships and communities that are working in coalition to face down power. Important, because if we don't do that, if we don't reach that understanding, we were talking last night and Tobastai said, we don't have 2 years, we don't have 5 years, we have to start doing this now. And so for those of you who want to take this conversation further and want to think about how we strategize and go further, we invite you after this panel. We don't want to take away from the headlines, but this is our chance. If people want to have a further conversation about this, some of us will be in the lobby after this panel to talk about where we go, what are the next steps to take. So I invite you to join us if that is something of interest to you. And I'm just going to wind up here now, because I've seen the 1 minute sign from the front, and I'm gonna hand this to Tobastai. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much. Tobastai. Guinea's at you, Taka's at you, Sky's at you. I'd like to, first of all, acknowledge the Ohlone people and them allowing us to present here today. The ancestors that have lived here and thrived here, their spirits are still with us, and I'm sure they're proud about the work that's been done this weekend. I spend a lot of time thinking about climate change because it's something that we're facing, not just on a global scale, but at our own community and regional scales. I grew up in Wet'suwet'en territory with my grandparents, as I was introduced. They taught me a lot about hunting, fishing, and trapping, and the seasonal rounds that we have to take. And through my lifetime, I'm in my mid-40s now, through my lifetime, I've witnessed dramatic change. There's places where I can't do things anymore. The seasonal rounds that we followed in the past have changed. We can't do certain things certain times of the year anymore. Sometimes things happen 2 or 3 weeks before we expected it to happen. And we end up scrambling around to try and see if we can seize that opportunity to go and harvest food for ourselves to put away for the winter. Life is becoming more and more difficult for us as traditionalists. People who want to live off of the land and do as much as we can to connect ourselves to this beautiful mother that supports us. It's becoming more and more difficult for us to achieve the simplest things of survival, the simplest things of knowing our relationship with the mother and all of the other creatures that we share this space with. There's so much happening with climate change that life is changing around us. I talked with some guys this morning. Now,
or last night there was an interview that was going on, and they asked me a question about what I thought about climate change in the future and the system. And I said, the system depends on us. And the system is designed to separate us from nature. But we depend on nature. And we need to hold up that responsibility to nature. As human beings, we're failing that responsibility today. Like I said to Salva this morning, we don't have the luxury of time in our hands. Time is not on our side now. It may have been on our side 3, 4, 5, 10 years ago, but time is not on our side anymore. I listened to some of the presenters this morning, and one of the things that was kind of stuck out was the Arctic ice shelf. It's melting. This cruise ship's been planned to go through there. The tar sands and the fracking fields are both dumping their waste into the Arctic ice shelf. They're dumping it into the Arctic ice shelf, and the Arctic ice shelf is melting. If you're not sure about the impacts of petroleum waste, have a look at what industry's doing. The fracking waste that comes out of Pennsylvania is being used as an ice melt in New York. They put them in tankers and they spread it out on the highways so that the highways will be safer for people to drive on. It's their way of dealing with a lot of their fracking waste. We have an urgency that we should be answering to. This planet is under the greatest duress it's ever been because of the complacency of the human population. In large part, the human population is sitting by and watching it all happen, spectators of this giant, massive play being played out. And we don't realize we're a part of that. We're living creatures that depend on that. But we're sitting back and hoping somebody else is going to step up and be that change. There's indigenous people from all over Turtle Island who are fighting the system today. I wrote a list of some of them. We have the Gitxan, who are our neighbors. They've been our neighbors for thousands of years. They started a camp this year called Mati Lee Camp, and they're stopping TransCanada from coming through their territories and all other pipelines. We have the Nisga grassroots movement. The Nisga people are in northern BC. They just signed an agreement with TransCanada to allow a pipeline through lava beds that are their sacred grounds. And the Nisga grassroots people stood up and said, I have not been consulted. And they're standing up and they're going to defend their traditional lands from the exploitation that is being proposed on by multinational companies. We have the Secwepemc people. Mount Polly, one of the most recent ones. This giant spill, this tailings pond, burst and let all this effluent of heavy metals into salmon-bearing rivers and are still contaminated at this second. They had no intention of ever cleaning it up fully. They still have no intention of doing that. They walked away from that problem and they're continuing on with business as usual. The Tahltan people from the north have the Red Chris mine to deal with. That same company that was responsible for the Mount Polly spill is responsible for the Red Chris mine. A third party they hired a third-party consultation firm to come in and have a look at the tailings design, the tailings pond design of the Red Chris Mine project, and they said there were so many problems with that that they're going to run out of paper writing all these issues that they're seeing with it. But the BC government, the British Columbia government, the Canadian government are still in full support of this company that led out one of the largest tailings pond disasters in Canadian history. We also have the Tsleil-Waututh people fighting the Kinder Morgan pipeline. You guys might have seen in the news recently, there's people being arrested. There's people who are fighting on the front lines of stopping this pipeline expansion company from coming in and increasing the capacity of the tar sands. We have the Cree trappers in northern Saskatchewan who are blockading petroleum companies from doing any work in their territories. We have the Mi'kmaq people fighting SWN, an American company, from coming in and doing fracking in their territories. We have Algonquin people who we've created alliances with very recently as well, who are fighting logging. The Tall Tan I mentioned, the Anishinaabeg are fighting Line 9. And of course the Six Nations fighting Energy East. This is a small handful of these groups. We have the Oglala as well. We met with the Oglala quite a few times. The Lakota, who are fighting the XL pipeline. We have responsibilities that we have to live up to. And I want to kind of share a story about some of those responsibilities. It's a story that my daughter shared with me. She worked, she had a chance to work with the Tlete Tene elder up in the north central part of our province. And she said that he shared a story with her. He said, in ancient times, our people were fishermen. Our people were fishermen, and we depended on the salmon that came up. But one year, the salmon didn't return. They waited, and they waited, and they waited, and they waited. The salmon failed to return. Towards the end of the natural fishing season, the salmon did return, but in really small numbers. So they decided, collectively as a community, as a nation, that they were not going to fish for salmon that year so that they would ensure that there would be salmon for future generations. In the following winter, more than half of the people died. They sacrificed themselves for the future generations. That's something that they were willing to do. And that story guides me today. It provides a light in this darkness that exists, that envelops in this system called civilization. It guides me and is providing a place for me to go. As a hereditary chief, as a traditionalist, I have no choice but to stop these frickin' pipelines from coming onto our territories. In order to win this fight, we're going to have to we're going to have to hunker down. We're going to have to get our knuckles bloody. But we're not going to do it alone. If we intend on making sure that this planet is going to be safe for future generations, we have to make sure that it's not just a fringe culture that is standing up and defending it. We have to make sure, and absolutely sure, that it's a popular culture that's going to stand up. We have to inject ourselves into popular culture today to get that message out there, because if the message doesn't get out there, our futures are doomed. And I'm an optimist at heart. Despite everything that our people have been through, despite the struggles, despite the climate crisis that we're living in today, I have to remain an optimist because I have children and I want grandchildren. But in order for us to remain optimistic, we have to escape from fringe culture, move into popular culture, and get our message out there. Do everything we can. We need to change our strategy. Because if we don't, each and every one of us are going to be doomed. And we're each and every one of us are going to be responsible for that. How it's up?
I'm going to speak up here because I'm used to standing. Spent 21 years teaching warrior societies, instructing. And I usually do it from a standing position, so I feel much more comfortable this way. And I want to begin, much like my brother did, by acknowledging the land we're upon and that of the Ohlone people. This is a custom of acknowledging because it reminds us of where we're grounded to. It reminds us of the land and of the importance. And I'm really happy to be able to begin any kind of teachings or talks in that way. Put our mind in the right place. What I want to do is kind of real quick talk a little bit about warrior societies as this community of resistance. We're talking about indigenous warrior societies. And to give you an example of what it's about, what it's like, so we can understand what does the community of resistance really look like. Not one that's just been around for a little while, not one that has just kind of been in a single issue kind of organization, but one that's been around since time immemorial. So we'll talk about that as a format. Now, in particular, those of you who've been around organizing, in particular, trying to get some type of organization built right from the very beginning, you might be a little bit accustomed to what I'm going to use for a moment, because I want to use it as a way of creating common language. Now, I'm sure you've heard that if you want to build an organization, you're going to start somewhere with a shared worldview, right? So we don't sit there and conflict all the time and argue over every little thing. Next thing you want to do is be able to have a strategic vision. You want to have an idea, what does this organization look like? What is it doing? What is it about? What is this kind of end state that this organization will achieve? From that strategic vision, you want to create strategic goals. Those strategic goals are just nothing more than objectives that are derived from that strategic vision. From there, we start to talk about what does a mission statement look like, and finally, a strategic plan. Now, that's a very formal way of looking at how to build an organization. But it might be a familiar way, because if you pick up a lot of text and you do a lot of reading, we're kind of always presented with these kind of step-by-steps. How do we do that? So I decided I'll use that as a common way of discussing warrior societies. So look at the common worldview, the first step. Warrior societies obviously have a common worldview. Can you hear me well enough about this paper?
Yeah.
I prefer to speak without that, all right?
Use one of those mics.
Without the mic, huh? That's definitely my preference. Okay, much better. It feels way too static and lacks energy, right? Not this really stuffy formal podium. So let me begin. All right, a worldview, a place where we can look back and find our legacies, our histories, our understanding of how we interpret the world. For indigenous people and warrior societies, this is easy. It comes from our culture. But what's important, I'm going to draw from that so you can understand this, is the idea of natural order. The world exists in its own natural order. It has its way of going about to ensure life will continue. Life will be there to reproduce itself. It doesn't need us. It doesn't need us to do that. There's an existing natural order that, if it was left alone, would ensure there would be an abundance of life around us. Now, as humans, we need to observe the mechanisms that ensure that natural order is in place. For indigenous people, we call that natural law. What mechanisms do we need to ensure that we don't interfere and cause problems with this natural order, the balance and harmony that ensures that all life will continue in a very flourishing way? Those are natural laws. And finally, we have a concept of natural justice, and that's the upholding of the natural laws. Those who deliberately choose to violate natural law have to be dealt with in some way. Now, luckily, for most indigenous people, it's simply a teaching, and it gets our mind back in the right place. But rarely, and once in a great while, there's an actual enforcement action. That is the role of warriors. They uphold natural justice. Now, as a slight aside to this, my people, the Mi'kmaq, we have the word smogness for warrior. We have a very important principle. We are forbidden to forgive. We are forbidden to forgive. Because if your responsibility is natural justice and upholding it, you do not turn a blind eye to injustice. You do not create excuses. You cannot forgive. You have to help maintain that balance of justice. That becomes our common worldview. Our idea of a strategic vision comes from our sacred responsibilities. Now this, you can talk to any indigenous nation and they all have their own interpretations. Sometimes we call this the original instructions. Sometimes we call it the sacred instructions. But real briefly, what it means is that we are here to protect our homelands, our version, our piece of Mother Earth. We're here to protect all life in those homelands. That's our responsibility. And not only do we protect it for the next seven generations. That means I have to ensure the whole land that I will hand over to the next 7 generations has to be as good, if not better, than the way I received it. And that becomes part of our responsibility. That is at the core of what warrior societies do and think. We have a responsibility to protect our homelands. This is not a hobby. This is not a career. This is not a choice. It is a sacred obligation. This is the very foundation of how warrior societies start to organize and understand what their job is. When we talk about strategic goals, we do come right back to that sacred responsibility. And we say our goals are about protection of that homeland. And we ask ourselves, what kind of actions, what kind of operations, what kind of things need to take place to do that protection? And we start to pick out our strategic goals, our strategic objectives, based on that. From there, when you've done the formal method of building an organization, you'd say, all right, I have a strategic vision, I have strategic goals, now it's time to make a mission statement. For us, our mission statement dictates the concept of doctrine. Now, I've heard people talk about the ideas of civil disobedience, nonviolence. That's a doctrine when it comes down to resistance. For warrior societies, our doctrine is a wide spectrum. We encourage the use of every possible tactic you can in a peaceful manner, but you do not write off the concept of self-defense because we have a sacred responsibility to protect that land one way or another. So this becomes the foundation of how we think, of how we operate. And for us, we can truly say this is something that wasn't just created in the last couple of decades. It isn't something that we just turn around and just thought up on our own. This has been a responsibility handed down from one generation to the next, to the next. Now, the Yati have a great way of describing their warriors, the Yoemi. They're called the protectors of the Hayakim. That's the name for their homeland. The Hayakim. Just a very direct way of understanding exactly what is their vision, their strategic vision, what is their strategic goals, or what are they, and what are their responsibilities. So when warrior societies say we are engaged in the protection of our homeland, we are engaged in the protection of nature, we are really saying we are exercising and living up to that sacred responsibility our ancestors have passed on to us, and we will pass on to the next 7 generations. So, speaking from a legacy of a 500-year-old war, speaking from that history of fighting colonialism, fighting the destruction of our homeland, for those of you that will commit yourself to this kind of fight, I tell you, welcome to the war. Whoa.
Whose territory I'm standing on, and it's part of our culture to always ensure that we're welcome onto another nation's territory before we come on, so I would like to thank the lady that gave the welcome this morning. So I'm Frida Houston, and I come from the Wunistaten people, and Wunistaten is people of the headwaters, and my people have protected our headwaters for time immemorial, and we have a hereditary system that has been in place for thousands and thousands of years, and our people were forced off our land probably about 100 years ago, where the government set up reservations and divided all our people into 5 different bands and forced us onto small tracts of lands to keep us off our lands. So in doing so, they were able to exploit all the resources off our lands, and probably 10 years ago or so, the people of my generation, because we've got brought up culturally by my parents, aunties, grandparents, always took us out to the land to harvest berries, hunt fish, and every time we went back to our territories, we just noticed more and more of our territory was decimated, and every time we'd sit around, we felt like we didn't have a voice, that we were silenced. The residential school silenced our people so that we couldn't speak up for ourselves and taught our elders that we couldn't speak out. And when we first started coming to our elders saying that we needed to do something, I said, if we don't do anything, there will be nothing left for our future generation. We don't want to be telling our children the stories that we used to have salmon. We used to hunt moose on this territory. So our generation spoke to our chiefs and said that we need to do something. Look around. There's only like 10% of our land that is usable anymore because everything is destroyed. It has been overlogged and they have mining and now pipelines are threatening the last remaining 10% of our territory that we have left. If we permit those pipelines through, the future generations will have nothing. And we started Unistaten Camp probably about 5 years ago because the pipelines were being proposed probably 7 years ago. And even though our hereditary chiefs had said no, a definite no to these projects, industry and government was still trying to skirt around our hereditary chiefs and still go ahead with their projects. So because of the crookedness of industry that they still try to come in even though we said no when we're burying my brother, they knew, I'm pretty sure they had inside people telling them we're busy with the funeral, so they called the drill company and gave them 5 telephone calls and said, you need to go in now, you need to go in now. And they were saying racist comments about us indigenous people, and one of the employees of the drill company didn't like what they were saying, so they called one of our hereditary chiefs, and we were still sitting at my brother's wake the night before the funeral, and he came down and spoke to my chief and said that if you're going to stop the pipelines, they're planning to go in 5 o'clock in the morning. So after that meeting, Tagastai came down to the wake, and after the two chiefs had met, he sat down with them and said, at their word, he would go up to the territory and just miss the funeral. So that's what ended up happening. Tagastai, one of my uncles and my cousin decided to go up, and by midnight, the night of the wake, they drove up the 2-hour trip to the territory, and sure enough, 5 o'clock in the morning, the drill company was trying to come into our territory. And it's these dishonest tactics that forced us to put up a full-on blockade 3 years ago, and 5 years ago we built a cabin right in route of the original Enbridge and Pacific Trails pipeline route. And 2 years after that construction of the cabin, they moved their route 1 kilometer and 3 kilometers upstream from where we put our cabin. So we put a pit house in the other route where Pacific Trails is planning their route, and we are now planning another cabin probably 3 kilometers up and a healing lodge. Because to me, residential schools did their job to take the Indian out of our children, and we want to create a healing lodge. We'll put the Indian back in our children. Because our belief is Tagastai and what we're doing is because we still have the Indian in us, because our parents and grandparents made sure of that. And my grandma lived to be 113 years old, and she was the one that she outlived all her children. So she taught the grandchildren where all their territory was and taught them how to live off the land. And they, in turn, our parents, taught us how to stay connected to the land. And because we were connected to the land, we're going to stand up for the land. And everybody else that's not standing up for the land have a disconnect. And I must honestly say, probably about 7 years ago, I almost got disconnected because I went to the public school system that said I had to get an education, I had to get a job, I had to buy a house, I have to buy a car. So that is the kind of lifestyle I led probably for 14 years. I had a full-time employment where I paid off my house, paid off 5 cars, kept trading in my vehicles for brand new vehicles, till I came to the realization that I needed to change my way of thinking. And that's how I had to decolonize my mind in order for me to change what I was doing and how I was doing it. And I've made the decision that I will not buy a brand new vehicle again. And right now, I just buy everything use, recycle, or anything I buy, I try to hang on to it for 10, 20 years and make sure it lasts, because I don't want it to go into the landfill, or else figure out a way how to fix it so that it's still usable. If people change their way of thinking, that's the only way we're going to see change. We have to make change with ourselves before we can make change for the world. And it starts with yourself. So we've been running an action camp. This last August was probably our fifth action camp. And 5 years ago we started that because even though we're traditionalists and people always ask me when I became an activist, I said I never became an activist. I was born into protecting everything around me because we're connected to it. We were taught to take only what you need, give back, and always ensure that the land is going to sustain you. Your generations, 7 generations down the road, that your children, your grandchildren are all going to have use of the land. And where we have our camp, we actually have a river that flows by it that you actually still can take a cup into the river and drink it. It's that clean. And that's where they're proposing to put the pipelines underneath these rivers. And that's where our salmon spawn. And during the action camp, we have about 200 or so people that come from all over the world, and we come together, and we have different workshops, like decolonization workshops, and how to get your messaging across so that you get out via media what you really want, the important things you want to get out. And we also started running spring camps, which we had the second annual spring camp this last spring. We have it in May, where we run a 3-week camp where volunteers from all over come in and help us. They helped us the first year with the permaculture garden, which we also put in the way of Pacific Trails Pipeline, and also put in a pit house in the first spring camp. And then the second spring camp, we put in a bunkhouse, which a bunch of people from the Lower Mainland in Vancouver fundraised. I think it was $30,000, and a bunch of volunteers put up a bunkhouse within 3 weeks, just so that there would be space for people to sleep when they come to volunteer. And like I said, we're talking about putting in a healing center, because my niece is going to be finishing her doctorate in psychology, and she wants to help our young people, because right now our young people are lost. They have a lot of indigenous communities, you see high rates of suicide. It's because our young people are disconnected from our lands, they're disconnected mm-hmm. from our culture, because they're told they have to dismiss who they are and become like Europeans. And when they're telling us we have to dismiss who we are, they're spiritually dead. And that's why there's so much suicide. Because if you're spiritually dead, then you don't feel like you belong. And I am so thankful that my parents and my grandparents did their duty to instill my culture into me so that I could stand firm and stand strong, and I'm not going to waver from to no bad industry will come on our lands ever.
Yeah. All right.